Thanks, Karin. Well, I'm from Bucknell University, which is a primarily undergraduate institution in central Pennsylvania. Here it is. I've never given a talk to a group composed primarily of theorists before, so I'm sure I will learn a great deal today about presenting my work to you and also in conversation with you. And so, of course, metallic glasses, as you know, are amorphous metals. And I'll be talking about my experiments, primarily compression experiments related to them. But before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge some of my recent collaborators, Karin Dahman and Jim Antonaglia from the University of Illinois, and Todd Huffnagel and Stephanie Slaughter at Johns Hopkins University, and my postdoc, Xiaojun Gu, and my student, Rachel Beyer, who is now a PhD candidate at Virginia Tech. So why are engineers interested in bulk metallic glasses? Well, as you can see from this plot of strength, yield strength as a function of their elastic limit, metallic glasses are unlike any other material. They have extraordinarily high strengths, ranging from 2 gigapascals up to 5 gigapascals or even higher, and they sustain enormous elastic strains at their yield point of nearly 2%. So for comparison, this makes them at least as strong as the strongest tool steels, and they have a higher strength to weight ratio than steel or titanium. And so they have other advantages as well. Because they undergo a second order phase transition, we have near net shape casting, which gives excellent surface finishes superior to CNC machine parts in some cases. They can be injection molded at temperatures above their glass transition temperature, and this makes them potentially useful in a variety of applications due to their high hardness and strength and excellent corrosion resistance. And in fact, some tech blogs are speculating that future iPhones or MacBook casings will be made from metallic glasses. I think in part that's kind of a cool design feature that Apple is after, but it makes sense too in terms of their hardness.
So they would bend less.
Yeah. well, they're actually quite flexible, but the problem now, of course, is that it's so thin, those new casings. This is work from Jan Schors at Yale, where he has shown thermoplastic molding of metallic glasses at small length scales and also hot embossing. So essentially stamping of the metallic glass at temperatures above the glass transition temperature. And so this shows promise for using metallic glasses in MEMS devices, possibly replacing crystalline metals in some applications. And so the way in which metallic glasses are formed is to rapidly cool them from the melt. And so typically we're working with multi-component alloys, 3 elements or more, where we see large differences in the atomic radii of the constituent elements. And so this then requires large chemical fluctuations for critical-sized crystalline nuclei to form. And so what we see here is a time temperature transformation diagram for Vitriloy 1. This is an excellent bulk glass former that was developed at Caltech. And so if the metallic glass liquid is cooled from the melting temperature of 937 Kelvin at a rate of only 1.8 degrees or less per second to the glass transition temperature of 625 degrees, a fully amorphous solid will form. And so something special about this metallic glass is that it also has a large reduced glass transition temperature. So that means it has a relatively high glass transition temperature compared to its melting temperature. And so then there's a small temperature range over which critical-sized crystals could form. And that's because these special compositions that form metallic glasses typically occur near deep eutectics. Yes.
So by melting in this 5-component thing, you mean the liquids?
Yes. And so these metallic glasses are also strong liquids in the molten form, meaning they have very high viscosities, about 3 orders of magnitude greater than a comparable composition that does not form a glass. And so then there are sluggish kinetics that hinder the diffusion and, again, the ability to form crystals. So this is my lab at Bucknell, and we make metallic glasses here in a ways very similar to how other people make them. This is a welding power supply here on the right, and this is a bell jar furnace under vacuum. And so we simply put the constituent elements in the correct proportions in these 4-part copper molds, and then we heat the metals until they are liquid. We mix and remelt several times under an argon atmosphere, and then we suck the molten glass down into this water-cooled copper mold, and that is sufficient to form a metallic glass. And so here we see a rod cast in this way. This one's about 4 millimeters in diameter. If you held metallic glass in your hand, it's unlikely that you would realize there's anything special about it. They typically have densities on the order of that of steel. And they certainly look like a metal. So often I talk about the mechanical behavior of metallic glasses compared to that for what we expect for crystalline metals. So of course, in a crystal, the fundamental unit of deformation is the dislocation. And so we have the extra half plane of atoms that progressively propagates through the material by breaking and reforming bonds. And so we understand that this is what gives rise to the macroscopic mechanical behavior. So this is a plot of true stress versus true strain, so the applied load divided by the instantaneous cross-sectional area as a function of the change in length divided by the instantaneous length for a piece of crystalline brass pulled in tension. And so dislocations explain the magnitude of the yield stress, so when the stress at which we start to see plastic deformation, and they also explain this work hardening behavior, why the stress increases with strain. And so for comparison to metallic glasses in a moment, this yield stress is relatively low. We see work hardening, which we do not in metallic glasses. And whether we're looking at compression or tension, we can see plastic strains on the order of tens of percent. Okay. So now for comparison, these are stress strain curves for metallic glasses tested in tension on the right and in compression on the left. And so in blue we have that same zirconium-based glass, and in red we have a different glass formed from palladium nickel phosphorus. And so in comparison to the previous slide, in tension the metallic glass simply loads elastically and then fails without any plastic deformation. And we see it does sustain about 2% elastic strain at that breaking point. And now here in compression, again, we see these very high yield strengths and a relatively low modulus for such a high yield strength. So for most metallic glasses, we see this 2% elastic strain at yield, which is very large. In a crystalline metal, we'd expect to see 0.2% elastic strain. But what's different from the metallic glass is the serrated flow behavior, we call it. And so what we see is that there's no work hardening, but under a nominally constant applied stress, we see these repeated cycles of a sudden stress drop followed by elastic reloading.
Well, that doesn't happen in crystals, sorry?
Only under very unusual circumstances, for example, when we have dislocations that are pinned by solute atoms and then break free, but this is not a general phenomenon.
So, two questions. One is the stress is not zero, the yield strain, is that something that I should
know? Oh, that is. Right. So it is close to zero. That just comes from some non-linearities in the initial loading. It's nearly zero.
But you said 0.2% of the yield stress of a bar.
No, for a crystalline metal. For a crystalline metal. So for a metallic glass, we see about 2% elastic strain at the yield stress. Mm-hmm.
No, I was trying to compare the modulus. It seems roughly, I mean, how big is this compared to the metal?
Oh, so most metals typically have elastic moduli in this range, but higher strength metals, so a steel, would have an elastic modulus of 200. So it's about a factor of two. Mm-hmm. Yes, Corey?
The serrations, do they occur at any point along the stress strain curve? So you focused in on the plateau of the plastic region.
Mm-hmm. So we might see some down here prior to yielding, but not, we wouldn't expect to see it during the elastic loading unless we had some really severe stress concentrations where the stress might be higher.
Are you going to talk more about the serration?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. That's mostly what I'm going to talk about.
Is it just a question of signal to noise or scale? I don't see any.
I don't think so. No. Well, if the stress locally at an area was very high, then that could lead to a serration. But assuming that we don't have anything that's leading to high stresses, so a locally high stress compared to this kind of remotely applied stress, I wouldn't expect to see those.
You do have a lot of heterogeneity in the system, which is the reason to concentrate stresses in the regions. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
for example, if you're doing a simulation of a small system,
mm-hmm.
there's no reason why I wouldn't see serrations in the linear regime versus the other one. So, the other quick question I had is, does the nonlinearity at low strain, does that depend on preparation, and should I think of this as the state that you achieve in the linear regime different from the state that you initially prepared? Because it seems initially very weak, but then you strain it and it, you know, becomes this linear material.
Yeah. You mean down here?
Yeah, down here. So it's
okay.
It's nonlinear, and then
so. Maybe we could come back to this. These are actually variable plots. So I've developed a much tighter system now, and I think potentially, we need to look at, but I'm hoping it's a little better in that region.
So is it not just the machine we see here?
Oh, no. No. So we'll come back to that. Let's get to the experiments I've been doing now, and then we'll talk more about the exact details of that. So there, I just meant to show kind of the overall behavior in the plastic deformation. So when we see each one of those serrations, what we can see on the sample is that a shear band is forming. So this is the experiment that I'm doing. I have rectangular samples. They're about 6 millimeters tall, typically, and 2 millimeters on each side. And I'm loading it at constant displacement rate compression. So the strain rate is about 10 to the minus 4 per second. That's a quasi-static strain rate. We can go a little slower, but that's a typically slow compression rate.
Are there any constraints on the sides?
No. And we use lubricant in between the sample and the loading platens.
That's just free surface.
Mm-hmm. And so then the sample loads elastically up to the yield point, and then a shear band forms. So this is an intense region of deformation, typically about 10 to 20 nanometers thick. And so the deformation is very localized into the shear band, and so we don't see plastic deformation away from the shear band. The shape change, the applied load is being accommodated by the formation of these shear offsets. So it's constant displacement rate compression. So in the moment the shear band forms, the loading platens are essentially stationary. The shear band propagates, and then the load drops. And that's why we're seeing this serrated flow behavior.
Sorry. It really means that you see all the plastic deformation within 20 nanometers,
yes.
And then the rest is...
That's the thickness of the band. Mm-hmm. These offsets can be hundreds of nanometers to microns long. And we'll look at some images of those in a minute.
Okay.
But there is no plastic deformation outside that geodem?
No, no.
But not much.
Not much.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
What's the scale? Is it none or like?
I think it's essentially none, yes. And so then we have more shear bands will form. Okay, ultimately the sample will fracture, and we'll talk about fracture. And now I'm going to show you scanning electron micrographs. So here, this is one point of view we're going to take, looking onto the edge of the sample. Okay, and then the other point of view is going to be looking top down along the loading axis onto the little shear step that forms here. So here we are. This is a palladium nickel phosphorus. So this is the edge of the sample. The vertical direction is the loading axis. And this is the shear step that's produced. So this is a 5 micron long marker. So it's a few microns in length. And then here, this is looking down now. So along the loading axis onto a shear step that's formed on a different sample. And again, we're seeing these steps are a few microns in length. Okay. And now again, here we have shear bands. This is the loading axis, the edge of the sample. And so the shear bands are typically oriented at about 45 degrees to the loading axis, near the plane of maximum shear. Okay, and so here, this again is not my exact experimental setup that I'm focusing on in my presentation, but I want to show you what happens when we're fracturing a metallic glass. So this sample is about 8 millimeters in diameter. It's holding many thousands of pounds at this point. But in the moment of fracture, we see that emission of light. And so this is one reason why people have speculated that there are large temperature increases during the fracture event. And in fact, we do know that hot particles are emitted from the surface during that moment of fracture. And this is the sample after the fracture event. It primarily, it fails along one dominant plane. And here I believe this to be damaged due to the very high forces that it sustains when it hits its enclosure as it fractures.
So
No comment needed.
Okay, so if we look at the fracture surface, we do see features that strongly suggest that localized heating occurred. And we'll show some modeling that is in agreement with this. But one experiment done by some others, Landowski and Greer, that I've been interested in for some time, involved doing a 3-point bend experiment on a bulk metallic glass. This was under quasi-static loading, and they deformed their samples to the point of failure. And they deposited, sputter deposited a tin coating onto the surface. And this is what tin looks like when it has melted on the surface of the metallic glass. And what they found was that when their sample fractured, the tin that was on the shear bands that formed melted. And so we need a temperature excursion of 200 degrees in order to melt tin. And so in order to produce a temperature rise of at least 200 degrees, their modeling indicated that the elapsed times during the shear band formation must be very short. Okay, and so that has been something that's interested me. How are these times really short to cause heating like this prior to failure? I'll give you a preview. My answer is no. But they are short enough during the fracture event. And I'll show you the data that supports this. So the key experimental challenge with metallic glasses in studying these shear bands is that shear bands are localized in both space and time. They're very thin, they produce small displacements, but they propagate, whether it's slow like I say or fast like others say, they're still propagating relatively rapidly compared to other things that we tend to measure using macroscopic mechanical measurements. So they're difficult to observe and characterize experimentally. And so some of the key questions I'm interested in are, how fast do they travel? What is their mode of propagation? Are they hot? How are they related to fracture? And what is the fundamental nature of the microscopic deformation mechanism that's producing them? And so there are some real experimental issues beyond what I've already talked about that we have to deal with in metallic glasses. Samples, even of the size I'm talking about with millimeter dimensions, are extraordinarily stiff because they're so strong. And so we have to take into account the finite stiffness of the load frame. And in many cases, that actually limits our ability to achieve plastic strain in these materials. Again, because they're so strong and stiff, because they're relatively stiff, we get specimen bending. And that can lead to artificial ductilities. And then we also, the specimen aspect ratio can influence our results, whether it's 3:1 or 2:1 or a 1:1 aspect ratio. And then we see these heterogeneities due to casting flaws. And so then we might see some stochastic behavior. Yes?
So those idealized stress strain plots you were showing, the serration started around 2%, or the plastic behavior started around 2%. What are these fracture strains? Are they?
They vary, and that can vary quite a bit, I would say, depending on how the specimen is loaded, if great care is taken to do that, if the loading is uniaxial. But typically, they range from maybe 1% plastic strain up to several, maybe 6-7% plastic strain for monolithic glass. But then we also have composite glasses now that can have higher plastic strains.
Would you see a change in the serration behavior and then some signature of the shear band? Or? When it fractures or pre-fracture? Do you know what I'm saying? So in the, I guess you're going to show them.
Yeah.
But you said they proliferate, right? The shear bands proliferate.
Yeah, well, we can see as few as no shear bands. It simply fails, presumably as a first shear band is starting to form, or we can see hundreds or even thousands. Can vary significantly. And so one of my challenges in working with Karin has been to find a composition under the conditions that we could have enough serrations to look at the statistics. Yes?
May I see the previous slide again with your question, though?
Yes.
The question which I have since 15 years is, what is there before the shear band? I mean, the shear band is something which has a history. What's the nucleus? What is the origin of the shear band?
Okay, maybe we could just talk about that in a little bit.
Okay.
On the serrations, can you tell if there are big ones and little ones?
Yes. We'll look at the statistics of them.
But you think they're all shear bands?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad.
You didn't know you'd have so many opinions.
So what I'm going to show you, what I've spent a good deal of time looking at, is the high-speed data and image acquisition. So we're going to see the shear bands propagating. This will provide some of the answers, but not all of them. And so then working with Karin, we've applied the mean field model of slipping weak spots to our macroscopic mechanical measurements. So we'll look at the different statistics that we get in measuring these serrations. Okay, so I don't even want to look at this one anymore. So first I'll just comment on the mechanics of the load train. So I said that the it's the ratio of the sample to the machine stiffness that's important. And so this is a very simple model. Others have done more elaborate ones. But if we simply model our load train as being two springs in series, one representing the sample, one representing the machine, and then a plastic element that is attributed to the sample, we can calculate the stress drop that is produced for a given increment in plastic strain. And so when we do this, we find that the stress drops that we can expect when the machine is much stiffer than the sample is very large. So that very quickly reduces the driving force on the shear band and tends to lead to stable or multiple serrations and stable flow. But if we have a compliant machine where the sample stiffness might even be less than the machine stiffness, then we're getting a very small reduction in the stress for a given increment in strain. And so we find that in that case, we get few serrations, if any. And so the ductility then is a function of the machine stiffness. So in general, I try to use as stiff of a machine as possible.
Could you comment on your machine relative to sort of like, you know, the Caltech machines that were doing this, where theirs is a lot less stiff?
So let's look at this plot.
Okay.
So Caltech, whose work are you thinking of?
I'm just thinking of Johnson's.
So I don't recall seeing their stiffnesses reported, but if they're seeing any plasticity, it's probably comparable to what I've been doing. But I'll talk more about that in just 1 second. So these are experimental results showing unstable flow, so few serrations, if any, compared to where tests where multiple serrations were seen. This is not my work. This is from Han and co-workers. And so this is the machine stiffness plotted on the horizontal axis versus the sample. On the vertical axis, we have the diameter of the sample for a fixed aspect ratio of 2:1. I exclusively work with aspect ratios of 3:1 because I feel this can at times constrain the shear band propagation. So my experiments and for a slightly different alloy would be out here at roughly 3 × 10⁸ newtons per meter, or 3 × 10⁵ newtons per millimeter, and up here in this regime. Most people, if they're going, I would say, large mechanical test systems tend to be out here in this range of machine stiffness, but I have worked with systems where, depending on what was in the load train, it was sufficiently compliant that I got no serrations at all. And this was early on, and I couldn't understand why that was happening. No matter what I did, I'd load up the sample and see no ductility.
Can I ask a quick question about that?
So yeah, sure.
I can imagine that there's sort of, are you equating serrations with the turnover in the stress strain curve? Are those two things the same in your mind? In other words, in that unstable region, would I just basically see no plasticity?
Basically.
It would just, because to me, sort of the serrations could be sort of different from the, in other words, I could see larger or smaller serrations on top of the plasticity.
And that can't, yes. That they can be smaller or larger within a single test, and that would also be a function of the machine stiffness.
But the absolute size. Stable and stable. To some, I don't know.
So that to me, this means no serrations. That these unstable samples would load elastically to the same yield stress as this one,
uh-huh.
But we would see none of that serrated flow behavior. And when we look at the sample in the microscope, we wouldn't see shear bands
what
either.
What would it do? It would load up to that point and then
just break.
Okay.
Just break like that. That larger sample I showed did.
I'm sorry to ask, what's serration?
Serration is this decrease in the flow stress. So that sawtooth behavior
okay.
in the plastic strain. And so I think that, we'll get to that, but that's going to be the avalanche in the mean field model.
Can I ask a question?
So if you're, this is going back to the earlier question about what happens in the last part of the stress strain. So I guess one could, and probably people have done experiments where you sort of keep a constant, creep experiment at the stress that is part below the immune stress. Do you at all see any serrations in the sort of how this strain may or may not evolve there?
Well, certainly when we're at high loads, high stresses, we see that. If we just hold, then we can see some. And I expect at lower, somewhat lower stresses, we would see that as well.
But not below what you would sort of normally identify as the usual stress.
I think potentially we could see some, but that locally there, the stresses would be higher. And so I'm going to show you a device I designed then in order to operate my machine at higher stiffnesses than what we would see otherwise. So this is a common feature of mechanical test systems, the kinds you see in universities, where if we don't have a sample in our system, we just load the machine on itself in compression, we tend to see a bilinear machine stiffness. Where at these lower loads, the linkages have some slop in them, and there's compliance that needs to be taken out by applying a high load. So I'm able to put a large load on my frame in order to move it up into this higher stiffness regime. And the way that I do that is using this device called a subpress. So here's my sample sitting in this collar, the sleeve. And the sample is going to be compressed by these two tungsten carbide platens. And I have a ball that sits in the top of this upper platen to help with the uniaxial loading. But before the platen ever reaches this ball, it's compressing these three aluminum pillars that are initially taller than the height of the ball on top of the loading column. So what happens is these three pillars load up to a very high load, and that takes the slop out of the load train. And then the platen touches this ball and then starts to load the sample. And so I'm measuring the load only on the sample using this piezoelectric load cell located beneath the bottom platen. And so most people won't have a subpress like this. And then a piezoelectric load cell is fairly special. So this is, I chose this to look at the relatively fast propagation of the shear bands. A conventional load cell, well, I have one up here that's attached to the machine, it's not going to accurately reproduce the features of the serrations, but this piezoelectric load cell does. And so just a few more details. I've acquired data at different rates. I'll tell you as we go through the results. I just mentioned these load cells. I also have an extensometer, which again, the extensometer spans the length of the sample, but it is also not accurately reproducing the features of the serrations. In some cases, I have strain gauges applied to each side of the sample. And I pay special attention to the filters in my system as well. For these first experiments, I'm going to show the smallest bandwidth filter is 100 kilohertz on the strain gauge amplifier. And so here I'm just showing the precision alignment that I get in my system. This is stress versus strain for the four strain gauges applied to the sample. And I'll just say this is really remarkable, actually, to have the stress and strain line up so well, showing that there's no really very little bending in my system. Now, this is data acquired at 50 hertz, and I show this only to highlight what, at least when people first started looking at this, might be typical data that one might get, where we don't see any data points during a single shear band event. So this is strain versus time, but we don't see anything there. And so now this is using my system at acquiring data at 100 kilohertz. And I'm just going to focus on the load data here. And so this is data from the piezoelectric load cell. That has 180 kilohertz filter, low-pass filter on it. And what I want to focus on here is the elapsed time during this shear banding event. And so regardless of the serration that we're looking at in this particular alloy, palladium nickel phosphorus, we find that these events are on the order of 1 millisecond in duration, regardless of which ones we're looking at. And then to satisfy the Nyquist theorem, I also sporadically took data at 400 kilohertz. And of course, it's much noisier, but it shows the same temporal response. So now, though, that gives us a sense of the time elapsed during these events. But we have to make some assumptions about how the shear band is propagating in order to extract a shear band velocity. So on one extreme, you could say, well, it's a simultaneous shear. In this case, the shear band is moving across the entire width of the sample, inclined at 45 degrees to the loading axis at one time. And if that's the case, then the relevant length is just the shear step that is produced at the edge of the sample in order to calculate a velocity. So in doing that, we get a velocity of 2 millimeters per second. It could be, though, that the shear propagates progressively. So maybe it starts on one side of the sample and then propagates it across it, similar, in a sense, to the way a dislocation propagates. In that case, the relevant time scale is the width of the sample in this inclined direction at 45 degrees, and so then we would get a velocity on the order of a few meters per second. But I wanted to answer this question of, or attempt to answer this question of, how does the shear band propagate? And so for that reason, I acquired a high-speed camera. So I have a Vision Research Phantom camera. And so it has a maximum sampling rate of 500 kilohertz, but during fracture, we're able to sample at 80 kilohertz for specimens of our size. Now we're going to be looking at 6 by 2 by 1.5 millimeter samples. And then during steroid flow, we can image at 12.5 kilohertz. But the key feature of this that makes it different from other work is that the data from the load cell is acquired using a board that's synced and timestamped to the same clock as the camera. So I have load and images that are synced in time. And so this is the test that I'm going to be showing. I do have a non-zero stress here at the beginning. Again, I think that is just due to some nonlinearities in the system at the beginning. But then here, there are 22 serrations in this test. And I'm about to show you a video of a shear band that formed here. And so what I'm going to show you is a sequence of 8 images that are separated from each other by 80 microseconds. And now the images have been looped to run in the forward and backward direction.
What are we looking at here?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what we're about to see is, it's not playing yet. Okay, I'm gonna turn it on. Okay, so this is, the shear band is here. And now the top half of the sample is shearing. The top half moves down relative to the bottom half. So it's looping back and forth. So if you can see, no.
If you look at the top ones, you can sort of, like at the top of the picture, you can see the dark lines are moving very slightly relative to the bottom.
Okay, so I thought that might not convince you. So, but it's a simultaneous shear. And we see that we can use image correlation. So this is for the this is for one of the serrations getting close to the fracture event. So it's a relatively large one. The stress drop is 50 MPa, which is 150 newtons. And so here is a plot of load versus time for that serration, where I've indicated where each of the images in that video was taken. And then we can also use image correlation to track the displacements surrounding that shear band. So this is a technique in which a speckle pattern on the surface that's often applied with paint, but my samples have a natural grayscale variation that functions as a speckle pattern. So features of the surface are tracked by the camera, and then software computes the displacements or the strains that the sample undergoes based on movement of these facets or pixels. And so then this is the image correlation data. And so this is these are for the images that I showed. So we can see the shear band forming. And then more so than that, though, here is a plot of displacement versus the image number. So that's essentially time for different locations on opposite sides of the shear bands. So these open symbols represent positions on the upper half above the shear band, and the filled symbols represent positions below the shear band. And what we can see is that position 1 and 5 are moving, they have the same displacements at every stage. So it is, in fact, a simultaneous shear, at least for these large load drops.
So it's just going like this?
It's just right. Going like this. Everything is moving at the same rate,
yes.
Mm-hmm, rather than starting at one side and moving across.
Do you have any pictures at the beginning? Does it start at one side or
I have not yet captured the initial formation, so I'm working on that. I'm not sure I can do it. I have a new lens. We had been focused on fracture, and that's how we got on these later images. But looking at the mean field model, I do think probably the smaller avalanches are progressive in nature, and so I'll talk more about that. But I do not have any of the earlier ones yet.
Oh,
the colors are representing displacements. But really, that's just a visual aid. It's really this plot that we should be focused on that has the truly quantitative information.
The visual aid, please, again.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. I don't read anything into the distributions here. That's just noise, in my opinion. And it's the shear band here that we're focused on. But really, like I said, the quantitative information comes out here in the plot.
You need a 10 times faster camera.
I'm sorry?
You need a 10 times faster camera.
Oh, yeah. How about it? Do you have $500,000? So now, what I want to show you, this is not a video, again, that I'm basing quantitative information off of, but it's a nice video to show. This is a sample with a 2-to-1 aspect ratio. It's 10 millimeters tall, and this is the fracture event. And so those are the platens coming down, and the hot particles presumably coming off. Okay, but that is failure. And so, yeah, right? That's an understatement. But here now, okay, this is a different sample. One of my samples machined to precision tolerances, best method tests. And this is a plot of load versus time. And so this is from the piezoelectric load cell. And if we believe the piezoelectric load cell for this fracture event, it occurs over an elapsed time of about 30 microseconds. But for these really fast events, 30 microsecond events compared to millisecond events, the piezoelectric load cell isn't fast enough. Because what we see if we look at the images is that the sample's intact, intact, and here it's broken. And in fact, it's entirely broken. Because if you could look closely, maybe you can see from where you're sitting, the sample is not making contact with the platens anymore. So it's broken at that point. And so if we, the time elapsed between these two images, these are sequential images, is 12 and a half microseconds. So that's the upper bound on the elapsed time for the fracture event, in my opinion. So fracture is extraordinarily rapid compared to the shear banding events. And so then you ask, we ask, well, what about the Landowski and Greer experiments? No doubt the tin melted. They saw melted tin on their samples. And so we speculate, now this is work I've done with Todd Huffnagel and his group, using his samples in my system, looking again at tin deposited on metallic glass samples. But in this case, we're not going to let our samples fracture. They're not going to experience that final rapid unloading event. And so the contrast here is due to tin lines that are deposited onto the sample surface. They are 15 microns wide with a 5-micron spacing between them. So this is the tin as deposited. It's about 15 nanometers thick. We see these islands in the deposited tin. And now these are shear bands that formed in samples here that were not allowed to fracture. And so we see large displacements for in these shear bands on the order of 6 microns in this case. But we do not see any melted tin. But if we look close to the fracture surface for samples that were allowed to fail, we do see tin that melted. And in no cases, when we did not allow a sample to fracture, we did not see melted tin on our samples. But when the samples fractured, we did see melted tin. And so we can make predictions for the heating that occurs for these different scenarios, whether we're looking at shear bands that have propagation times on the order of, say, 1 millisecond in the alloy I was looking at previously, or in this specific case for zirconium-based alloy, our largest serration for the sample I showed had an elapsed time of 6 milliseconds, a stress drop of 3 MPa. In that case, we only get an expected temperature rise of less than 1 degree. Now, certainly, if that time elapsed time was much shorter, we would see a larger temperature increase. But there is no experimental evidence that supports a shear band velocity that is as fast as would be needed to produce melting of tin. But if we look at the fracture event, where let's just take an elapsed fracture time of 20 microseconds, that would give us a very large temperature increase, more than sufficient to melt even the metallic glass at the fracture surface. And so that is, in fact, with these consistent with the micrographs that I showed earlier. During fracture, the stress drop is enormous. It's happening in a very short period of time. The stress drop rate is more than enough to cause melting on the surface. And we see features that suggest that, in fact, melting occurred. But if we're talking about the shear band propagation prior to failure, then, in fact, we see these smooth surfaces. We don't see melting, and that is also consistent with our measurements and our temperature predictions. And so what do we think happened? I think that potentially during, and this has been observed by others, potentially during the failure event, elastic waves emanated and then reflected off of the specimen grips and then caused new shear bands to form. And those shear bands do experience a large stress drop rate that occurs due to the failure event. So this is those shear bands where the tin melted in the Landowski and Greer experiments, I believe, formed during fracture. Yes?
So one of the conclusions of that Greer paper was also trying to estimate a length scale for the width of where the temperature was large.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really exciting because it tells you that maybe that length scale that they extracted was a result of something else So the question I have for you is now that you have sort of this nicer method, is there something you could use other than tin that would melt so that you could get a new estimate of sort of the length scale of the shear bands? In other words, yeah. I really want to know what the correct answer to that is now.
So for the length scale,
The width of the shear band.
So there is a paper using rose gold. I can't remember what the melting temperature is there or what their widths were, but that was an attempt to do something similar. But they had a uniform coating on their specimens.
Yeah, I would be really excited with your new way of doing it where mm-hmm. you don't get this fracture stuff because you could, it seems like you could have sort of the definitive right. measurement of how wide these things are,
right.
which is really useful for theories.
I agree. It's just the challenge of finding the right coding.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we'll talk some about the measurements I made and have been working on with Karin. So this is a zirconium-based metallic glass that has shown some good ductility. And again, this is in compression, a plot of true stress and true strain. This is the sample, it's being deformed. If we were to look at higher magnification images, we would see many shear bands distributed out throughout the sample, but there was also one shear band that dominated the strain. And so here, this is a plot of stress versus time. For these shear banding events. And so we are looking at the statistics of these events and interpreting them in terms of the mean field model. And so, of course, then that model assumes that there are weak spots in the material that slip. They are coupled elastically to other weak spots. So a slipping weak spot can trigger other weak spots to slip, and then that produces the avalanche that is the shear band.
Can we go back one time?
Sure.
So is it all scale? So if you there's fluctuation. So in the main plot, there's drops like that one.
Right.
But there's also fluctuations on the linear regions.
This is noise, the noise in the load cell.
You're just focusing on that part, or also
we're focusing so on these stress drops. So they range, the ones that we're going to focus on range in size from about 0.3 megapascals up to 3 megapascals.
Well, I was asking if I look at the right-hand plot.
Oh, these are the ones we're focused on. Yes, you don't see the noise in this plot. Here, the larger drops that do range in size. Over typically two orders of magnitude, these are the ones that we are focused on.
But there's this blue side.
This blue portion is this here.
So are you lumping all of them together when you do the statistics?
Well, I'll show you. Okay. So here now, this is the complementary cumulative distribution function for the avalanche size. So it's giving us distribution of avalanches or the fraction that has a size larger than S here on the horizontal axis. So yesterday at the talk, we were talking about an exponent of minus 1.5. That would be when we have avalanches smaller than our size S. But when we plot the CCDF here, we get a slope of minus 0.5. So this is a guide with a slope of minus 0.5. And now this is the scaling regime that we're going to consider. So we're restricting ourselves out of all those shear bands, avalanches that we observe in the test. We're restricting our discussion here to the scaling regime. From 0.3 MPa to 3 megapascals.
Yes. That wasn't what I was asking.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I sort of visually see an evolution of the distribution as you, so the distribution close to that onset of plasticity seems different from later on. That's all I was asking.
She uses all the ones though.
Yeah.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah.
So you're lumping them together, but maybe there are different.
Yeah.
No. If you slice it in windows, you actually get the same statistics in that range that she uses. So she
even in that blue box, first, if I drew that same blue box that she's drawn to the right hand side, I would get the same statistics.
Yeah. You get different if you go lower than that, but not up there. We actually checked it, so it's the same.
But why do you use a cumulative distribution?
You could do PDF either way. I mean,
cumulative is if you have a defect, I mean, a problem somewhere, then the whole thing is screwed up.
No, this is very, you can do either way. You can plot it either way. You get it consistent. So the 0.5, she was just pointing out 0.5 corresponds to 1.5, which you do with the PDF. You can do either one.
Just like red squig statistics.
Exactly. That's what she's going to get into. Yeah, exactly. And she's going to explain that.
Should I think of each one of these drops as breaking a new shear band in a different location or the same shear band over and over?
It could be either. It could be, it is both. It is both.
And there's no, can you distinguish between one and the other?
I think we can. I'll show you.
Okay.
So here now, this is the maximum stress drop rate as a function of avalanche size. And so we're seeing two different regimes, and I think that is talking about this difference. So the small scaling regime, we believe, are the progressive slips. So these are the ones that I have not yet captured with my camera. These are very small stresses. I know that I do not yet have the resolution to see these shear bands events as they occur. And then here, the ones that I have captured with my camera are larger in size, and we know that these larger shear band events occur in a simultaneous fashion. So we believe that this transition from this scaling regime, so what we're calling the small avalanches, to the large avalanche scaling regime is due to a transition from progressive to simultaneous shear. Now, that's not to say it starts out progressive and then goes simultaneous. These events are interspersed with each other. We can see small, as we saw in that other plot, and as Karin said, we see throughout the test, we see small ones, then large ones, and then small ones again. So we think that these shear bands are nucleating at stress concentrations, propagating in a progressive fashion. Then the shear band has fully formed, and then it will proceed subsequently in a simultaneous fashion. So those shear bands that I have seen with my camera were previously formed. And so then those are the ones that we see propagating in a simultaneous fashion.
Avalanche size of stress drop?
I'm sorry? Yes, the avalanche size is the stress drop. And so again, here's a guide with a slope of 1/2, which is predicted from the mean field model for the maximum stress drop rate as a function of avalanche size.
The distinction of progressive versus simultaneous, in the case of the progressive, the speed of propagation is something that is much less than sound speed.
The shear wave speed in these solids is on the order of, say, 2,000 meters per second. And so my measurements indicate that these speeds are, in fact, more like millimeters per second. They are not anywhere near the shear wave speed, except perhaps during the fracture event.
So they're spatially isolated events, should I think of them that way? They
are spatially isolated. Yes.
So I think that's maybe, I don't know if that's what, so I wonder if those happen even in your elastic regime. I think that's what a few of us are thinking about. It's just, you will not see these.
Did Jim find them?
So yeah, if you look in the elastic regime, there's very few small ones, so you not nearly as much as the regimes yet.
It would be interesting to see what happens to the density or, do they aggregate at that point before the shear bands form, like the ones that are spatially all over the place.
But there were like very few, not enough to do really good statistics.
What is the scaling exponent for the large shear bands?
The scaling exon? I don't know.
So the large ones, they tend to be, they're just at the shoulder at the end. So she'll show you the
okay.
Yeah.
And what was the loading? It was
10 to the minus 4 per second, the rate?
Did you vary that? So is it
we have not varied that yet.
It's related to this question of progressive, right? Because you know, this idea of you load it and then you wait for a certain amount of time, and what can another event happen during that journey?
It can. Mm-hmm. We've seen that happen. We've held at a constant stress, and then the sample has failed during that loading period. Now, you could argue I don't have perfect control of my machine, and so maybe there was some change in the applied load, but to the best of my ability, I would say that can happen.
Correct. This is not an AQS experiment.
No, ma'am.
I thought it was. She's doing a quasi-static time.
Karen, can you remind us?
She said she is doing a quasi-static time.
One half is the scanning for
the system.
For this, to the yes, to the half is the mean field scanning. So the dash line, always the dash line is the mean field that she shows.
Karen, do you have a comment about quasi-static? About the, just how your theory would deal with rate effects, whether you've gotten rid of rate effects.
In fact, I will show in the next meeting, the conference, I'll show so if you were going to shear faster in the mean field, we would expect that the fluctuations around the mean get smaller. So you can, it's sort of like, you know, if you think of it in the pinning picture, you know, you're shearing at a faster velocity, so you're moving away from the critical points, so you get a smaller cutoff. And in fact, there are some experiments where you can actually see that, but
these predictions are for the quasi-stat.
This is for very slow strain rate. This is for 10 to the minus 4 per second. So, but you
know. No, your predictions are for what?
Both. We can do.
No, both. This prediction.
The 1.5.
So this is the dash line.
The dash line is from the mean field quasi-static equilibrium. But it would survive. Yeah. I mean, she's very close to the critical point. Very slow. So yeah.
But my point is that she is an experiment. So that when it's shearing, it's really taking account of the internal dynamics and all the internal time scales of the system to be this model does not.
Okay. No. Okay. Yeah. But I'm saying
that's
I think
that's
this.
That's
why
I think it's important.
Okay.
So it's probably the thermal part or the non-inertial part. I mean, that's all, those are the different. It is quasi-static.
It doesn't do what AQS simulations do.
So now this is a plot of avalanche duration as a function of the avalanche size. So as in the scaling regime, as the avalanches get larger, the duration is longer. Again, we see agreement with the mean field model exponent. And again, you know, we see these two regimes of the small and then the large, which we're attributing to progressive and then simultaneous shears. And now these are the scaling functions. So not only do we show agreement with the mean field exponents, but we also see very good agreement with the scaling functions. So here, this is the average stress drop rate profile normalized by the maximum stress drop rate for avalanches of similar duration. And that's what these are showing here. And these are the mean field predictions on the right. And so down here, we've just subtracted, and Karn's group has subtracted the parabola, which the parabolic shape, which then shows us, highlights the symmetry that we see. And so then we're not seeing inertial or delay effects in these avalanches for the metallic glasses.
So again, this image, so these are focusing on these avalanches that are in that range.
Yes, in the scaling regime.
So what would it look like if there were inertial effects?
It would be tilted to the right or the left?
Yeah,
would
it
break the symmetry?
Right.
Exactly,
with
delay to the flash.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so now this is the stress drop rate for the avalanches in the regime, now grouped by size, and then scaled by a factor of 1 over the square root of the size. And we see that, as expected, according to the mean field model, these profiles for avalanches of different size collapse onto each other. And then this is also the expected shape from the mean field model. So we would say we have excellent agreement between the mean field model and the metallic glass data that I've shown.
So again, I'm just trying. So these statements about these avalanches that are not part of your simultaneous shearing events.
Right. These are the progressive ones in the scaling regime. Yes.
And you sort of said that you thought that these simultaneous ones were going along sort of pre-existing faults.
Yes.
That were generated, and you're going to show us some data about that? Or?
Well, no, I know from all of the videos that I have, I can see prior to the event where I'm measuring the displacements that it had already formed. So I have not recorded a simultaneous shear event in which there wasn't already a pre-existing shear band at that location. So I do not have direct evidence that the scaling regime avalanches that we're showing here are progressive ones, but that is a prediction from the mean field model. So that's what I kind of called an opportunity earlier. I don't have direct experimental evidence of that yet. The evidence that I have is consistent with the mean field model, and now the mean field model is informing my experiments back, telling me I should go look more carefully to see if I can see these small events.
Go back 1 second to the stress problem. Right? Yeah. So I would say that at best those are quartic. I mean, and whereas you're looking for parabolic.
No, but there's corrections due to the machine stiffness, and the right that's taken into account in the right.
Okay.
So
in B.
In B, that's correct.
Okay.
And so that flattens the shapes. That and also
the machine stiffness flattens the shape.
Exactly.
And can you correct it? Or
yes.
Is that impossible?
Yeah, that's why the
so which
right,
one is correct?
So the right is the mean field shapes. The B and D are the mean field shapes. The left is the experiment. So the right column is the mean field.
I see, corrected.
And you correct for the stiffness,
okay.
And then you get the flat.
The flat, okay.
That's right.
So the evidence I do have for some progressive shear is, for example, this is a metallic glass specimen that did not fracture, and it's an optical micrograph, and this is a shear band. Okay, these parallel lines are scratches from the polishing process. This is a shear band for which the displacements are very small. We cannot see a shear offset with our eyes in optical microscopy, but if we zoom in on this region, in the SEM, we see that it appears the shear band simply ends. So some shear bands do not propagate all the way through the sample. And so then, you know, this good agreement between the mean field model and the metallic glass data then provides experimental evidence for the shear transformation zone. So these collective rearrangements of atoms, about 10 to say 100, which is producing the shape change, the displacements in the shear band. They interact with each other and couple and lead to the avalanches, with the macroscopic manifestation of that being the shear band. And so then the implications of looking at the data and the mean field model together. Again, it's giving us some experimental evidence for the STZs. We are predicting two scaling regimes of which we can see the simultaneous shear for the large avalanches in this large scaling regime. And then we are assuming then that we have progressive shear based on the mean field theory.
Yeah, I just have a question. You can remind what is the mean field model of which elastic kernel? Is it the HMB kernel?
No, this is just the simple mean field. So you're saying we have the weak spots and you just have infinite range interactions.
Infinite range means redistribute strains are connected to the HMB tensor or something else?
Yeah, you could start with that, but if you are on a shear band, you can show with the randomization group that if you coarse grain in the shear band, because you have the slip.
Talk about mechanics, not about the randomization group. What is the law you use to redistribute the stress.
So just if you have a local stress drop, then that stress is redistributed to all the other weak spots.
It's mean field.
Oh, it's completely okay. It's mean field.
And then what are the two skating regions? The progressive. What are the mean field? What are the two skating regions?
The progressive is the scaling, the one with the 1.5 pounds.
What is it physically? I understand there are two different skating regimes, but you're calling one progressive.
One is the finite sizes.
Exactly.
One is the finite size effects. It's a characteristic length scale. And the other one is the progressive ones, which are where you have STCs, which are elastically coupled.
The progressive ones are...
So in the mean field, I'm trying to figure out how you distinguish since there's no spatial scale.
No, the progressive one is the actual scaling behavior where you know that your slips are small compared to the system size.
Uh-huh.
You don't have any spanning up. The other ones are the ones that where in the mean field we also have this weakening parameter where mm-hmm. the threshold goes down,
mm-hmm.
and that leads above a certain length scale, it leads to runaway events which are crack-like, and that's what we think is the simultaneous because in the mean field we get crack-like scaling, which says that all the way through everywhere things just keep slipping as the event progresses. And that's what she calls simultaneous slip. And those are those crack-like events. They're bigger than a certain length scale that depends on the weakening in the mean field model. Yeah.
Thank you.
Remind me, which one of the two was the 1/2 power law that you showed?
The progressive, the scaling, yeah, mm-hmm, where the weakening plays no role, yeah.
Well, this is my last slide, but we do, just to reiterate, we see the small avalanches and large avalanches interspersed with each other. The largest durations, the ones in those large scaling regimes, they shed the load most quickly, and so we can use those stress drop rates to calculate temperature increases, and again, none of those stress drop or force drop rates are sufficient to cause melting, except for the failure event. And so again, this is what the modeling would not have been possible without Karin and her group. And here, Todd Huffnagel and Stephanie Slaughter, they were responsible for depositing the tin on the samples and designing that particular experiment that we then performed in my system. And so thank you.
I think this is just lovely. It shows that at times we're talking the same language and at times we're not quite. What Karin, I wish Karin had already given us a seminar to prepare for this. I'm trying to remember all that I read here with the mean field and avalanche calculations. But what she's talking about is, you know, the system where a lot of different things and one's triggering another are going on. And it's a sort of a general point of view about how these avalanches, especially in this case, can form with related, not completely independent events. A number of others of us, most especially Lisa and I, and Aaron Bookbinder is coming next week, which we'll talk about, is more like the initiation or the propagation of individual ones of these shear bands. The question is what's the shear banding instability at the microscopic scale? How does it depend on which metallic glass you're actually dealing with? We also like to play with this idea of the temperature and the question of circumstances and what kinds of statistical temperatures you're dealing with. But that's that's zooming in at a much more specific level, and I think that fitting these things together is what we're doing here, and that's why I really like to see all this stuff.
I have a question for
Yes. I'll let him talk about it.
Okay.
I didn't see your hands, so go ahead.
I was just going to sort of, I'm Lisa, I lovely talk, and in particular, sort of to amplify what Jim had said, I would anticipate that there might be a crossover between, because of things like, you know, Michael Fox simulations and some of these behaviors when you go to higher strain rates or higher temperatures in bulk metallic classes. I would anticipate that there might be a really interesting crossover between the avalanche behavior that you clearly see and have demonstrated beautifully, and maybe other types of mechanisms for coupling between these STCs or defects. And I would think that the two, I can think of sort of three important control parameters, one being sort of the quench rate for the bulk metallic glass, because there's some, I think the prediction would be that the deeper you quench the system, actually, the perhaps more likely you are to get a different type of thing other than these avalanches for deeper quenches. And then the other two control things are the ones I just mentioned, the strain rate and the temperature, you know, at which you run these experiments. And so I think a lot of us might be interested in exploring the crossover, because, you know, one thing that I still remain curious about, and I mentioned earlier, is the length scale for these shear bands and sort of because so in these sort of avalanches, the only reason that you expect, you know, their width is extremely narrow because you just focus all of the stress in one direction, right? Basically, their width is zero, or limited to the length scale of an STC, right? Basically. And in these other models for shear bands that involve other interactions, then you expect the scale of them to actually be larger. And so I think this would be a really exciting way to differentiate between, or even ask, you've clearly shown there are shear bands which are avalanches. The question is are there shear bands that are other things? And the length scale would be really, I think, useful to differentiate between the two.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
So do you have an argument to justify it?
My question is this. If you look at avalanche, it's a really nice result. You see this. Also, I understand the reason you increase the machine stiffness so much. So you can actually increase your sensitivity to detect the responses, right? But the question is this. In all the other systems, you cannot detect what is happening inside if they actually not reach the boundary. The part that happens inside is very hard to detect because all your sensors, right, the displacement sensor, the piezoelectric sensor, you all detect what happens on the boundary. So that's my question. So what really happens that for those events that happen inside, that didn't show the boundary effect yet, you cannot detect it, right? So those are the things most relevant to all the talks. I believe how you run up to the final stage, for example, you have a slip, right? You detect it, you have a displacement change, you have a load drop. But what happened is that I have something inside that has not caused the displacement yet. So that's the puzzle actually for us, is that we do a lot of finite element modeling. You see tremendous production of shear events inside of the sample, but yet you don't see any serrated or avalanches from the stress strain curve if you actually put sensors on top and bottom.
Well, I mean, the acoustic emission sees that too, and then the acoustic emission tends to precede each of these avalanche events. I haven't done that yet. I'm interested in that. But
she does have micrographs that show it, granted, the shear bands show up on the surface.
Yeah.
And what she sees looks at an awful lot like what a whole bunch of people have seen in numerical molecular dynamics simulations.
So, it's actually for finite element, and you only have one avalanche.
No, well,
depends on how you do it. On how you construct your model.
Different ways, and
IMD modeling. If you have a large system, and Corey actually mentioned earlier, if you have a large system with more than 5,000 atoms, you don't see a shear band. You don't see
Certainly, you see shear bands. Mike Falk has been seeing shear bands for almost a decade. When you get into the sort of quasi-stationary regimes that I might call them, you see avalanches, cores, these all kinds of avalanches and analog systems.
I think it is interesting, though, if you do increase the system size, you can get a broader scale of avalanches.
Yeah.
For example.
Well, but that's because they're probing the system size.
Yeah, so I wouldn't go that far to say there aren't avalanches in larger systems, but in small systems, you have a narrower range of avalanche sizes. As you increase the system size, you can get very, 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 very small avalanches, and they may dominate statistics.
So I just want to pick up on what Lisa was saying in terms of different control parameters, but since this is a, but since you are sort of doing all this with metallic glasses, I want to sort of paraphrase Anderson and ask which of these, you know, which of these observations might help make better metallic glass? I guess that's sort of somewhere in the agenda for looking at all the spatial behavior of metallic glasses. And a lot is understood. So, is there a feature to focus on in trying to say, you know, if I don't want failure, this is what I should be doing?
Sure.
I don't know that I say that yet. I mean, what to do there? I mean, we are going to be comparing to different systems where we see larger ductilities typically, and so I'm hoping we might glean some insight from that when we have a second phase that then interacts with the shear bands in some way.
No, I was going to point out that you were already referring to the work of Schroers, who has this nice paper in which he shows that he, and what Lisa was, I think what Lisa was referring to, that, you know, if you quench more slowly, so that it's annealed, you toughen the material. Mm-hmm. If you quench fast, it becomes brittle, and we think we understand that.
No, the other way. If you quench quickly, you freeze in a lot more disorder, right? And so it's actually more ductile.
Did I say it the wrong way?
Yeah, I think so. I heard it the wrong way anyway.
No. In any case, if you anneal it, you get you anneal out the disorder, and then it becomes brittle.
Yes.
Okay, that's the physics, and then I can say it.
So how do you justify the mean field instead of taking a more realistic but more complex stress redistribution after further events, like the shell given distribution? So
you can show if you have slips in a shear band, you can show with a memorization group that the upper critical dimension for these scalings is actually the physical dimension. Two-dimensional fault. Yeah, three. Mm-hmm. So two-dimensional fault.
Okay.
So you expect to see.
Okay, but if you have the, I'm not sure, the critical dimension for the shell B redistribution, that is three also.
For the
one over R two. Redistribution.
Yep. One or more two interactions. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Exactly for that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. So actually, yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
This seems to confirm that. Yeah.
Okay. So one comment I was trying to emphasize yesterday was that the interactions for granular systems could be very different than in metallic systems.
In amorphous systems which are non-granular.
So one possibility is the in granular systems there are lots of weak forces. So if you look at a force distribution, it's finite at zero force. Whereas if you look at a structural glass, you know, you almost get a dip. It's more Gaussian at a finite force value. So there aren't a lot of weak forces. So is there any way of So one possibility would be that this, you know, mean field can describe almost anything. You do avalanches in granular materials, you do avalanches in bulk metallic glasses, but is there a knob that you can tune in the theory where you can sort of probe this? So preliminary results suggest that, so Mark Shattuck, Bob Behringer's arch rival.
Really?
Has these preliminary experiments to say the exponent is 1.3 or 1.35.
Can I
actually go back to say something before we get into exponents? I think it's also a question of where you're looking at the granular material. So I think if you look at things that are close to just touching, jamming, this has been known forever that these are not elastoplastic materials. And if I know anything about all of the stuff that all of you guys have done,
which is not clear, just kidding.
The interfaces are always elastic. The interfaces that you look at are elastic interfaces, right? And I'm not so sure that that assumption works for granular materials that have not been overcompressed. And your thing works for bulk, but those are overcompressed.
So exactly, for high padding fractions, exactly, you would expect it's like a solid. Again, you have weak spots couple, you would expect it works the same way. And so Bob is going to give a beautiful talk tomorrow on granular materials.
I don't agree that his experiments get the same exponent either.
Well, why don't we hold that question?
why don't we just shelve
that question?
But I'd like to emphasize that they're following up on what Corey said yesterday, that granular materials are not elastoplastic.
So it depends. So I would say
depends on where you are. If you overcompress them, yes.
Exactly. It depends on the packing fraction. So once you have granular material, so in the mean field, actually, we've added voids to it. And then you can see that as you go lower the packing fraction from highly jammed, you know, like going closer to the jamming transition, you expect that it would affect the cutoff. But we haven't.
But you're still assuming your interfaces are elastic. So.
But you can. We can look at the experiments and see. I'd expect it works.
One comment which I just learned from Kyron the other day, which is that you can change the exponents and not just the cutoff if you, instead of having long-range interactions, you only have short-range interactions between defects. Right. So if you have just short-range or nearest neighbor interactions. So I think that might be an interesting place to think. This is just my personal opinion now, because if you're really in a limit where this material is not behaving elastically anymore, and there really aren't these long-range 1/r² things anymore, and things are maybe even locally interacting with one another, then you could change the exponent.
So you're saying, like, if you're like really jamming,
and as I keep saying, I don't want to focus on exponents, but I think there's a crucial physical difference between granular materials, which people from the late mid-90s have emphasized are not elastoplastic, and think when they're just jamming.
We'll continue the discussion.
We need to distinguish
Can I ask a different question? So I understand that the experiments were done to focus on the fracture and on the failure of the material. But then you saw that there are this, whenever you have one of these failure events, this always comes from some shear bending that were propagating supposedly progressively in the material. And so doesn't this also suggest or makes you feel like now you should even go back and look where the shear bending events were coming from? What I mean is that you started to say, okay, there is this linear behavior and then there is the interesting stuff that starts on. Mm-hmm. But maybe there is this, the coupling between the shear bend and propagating in a different way actually comes even from what is happening in the material in the linear response. Mm-hmm. Because now if I look at your curve of the linear response, it didn't look so linear, I have to say. But maybe it's just that I haven't seen enough.
Right. Well, I think for macroscopic mechanical testing up to strengths that are that high, it really is pretty linear. I measure the elastic modulus very accurately, and that is a very difficult thing to do just with bulk mechanical testing. And secondly, I agree with you. My experiments don't have the resolution for that to look at the earlier events. Mm-hmm.
Because of your curve, I mean, I was just thinking how it would look like if I look at the log, and it seemed that it was a bit bending.
At the very end, at large strains, when we get the large offsets, yes, there's some a little bit of bending. I can't stop that. Yeah.
Okay, last question, and then I have
another. Thanks. A completely different issue. Can you show the two scaling plots again, to the power law one half?
One of these?
Two forward. Yes. Okay, so this one I like. I would call this pretty convincing. Can you go back to the previous one? Yes. This is what I would call not so convincing. But the avalanche size, have you truncated or is there a minimum?
Avalanche Oh, I think this is then, this, some of this is noise, so this, some here.
What of your axis? Have you truncated on purpose at this point, or is there a natural minimum of your measurements?
Oh, like to the left? Yeah, there's more stuff. Yeah, it's not strong.
No, because the point is, maybe the power law is so unconvincing, because maybe there is a minimum of the maximum to express appropriate, and there's a minimum of the average size. If you would remove, I would say 10 to the power 6 times 10 to the power 2 from the vertical axis, and 1.1 from the horizontal axis, from all your data, then you might get a much better scaling law. You see what I mean? You have the noise here. Doesn't that indicate that you have a minimum here? There's nothing here. Doesn't it indicate that you have a minimum here?
There's more data to the left.
But they are all, they look like a cloud here. This is a natural minimum. I mean, in some metals, domain sizes. Wouldn't that be correspondent?
You have a procedure in a paper, an archive by Daniel Bonamy to get rid of the noise there, to get a nicer, you can, this noise is Gaussian distributed, you can get rid of it, and get, maybe, if you follow the procedure, a better scale. You can look at it.
I mean, just send me the raw data, I'll show you what I mean. I mean, the few points, not the many points.
Yeah, okay.